يا ما أطولك مشيتني حافي.
All of us have dedicated our lives to the same hopes and dreams. We all stand for social justice and liberation in this country. The same way my people have dedicated their lives to the liberation of Palestine. Palestinian women are looking to this conference for your continued support of our rights, freedom, for Palestinian political prisoners, the right of return, self-determination, and independence, and one single liberated state where everyone is equal.
Rasmia O'Day is the Associate Director of the Arab American Action Network in Chicago. She has been a long-standing advocate for justice since her youth in Palestine, where she was imprisoned and brutally tortured by the Israeli government. Rasmia has been an American citizen since the mid-90s and has served the Arab community in Chicago for over 20 years. She is a beloved member of the international Palestinian community and has served as a mentor to many. On October 22, 2013, then 65-year-old Rasmia was arrested in her home by the FBI as a part of a larger, politically charged witch hunt to silence Palestinian leaders, anti-war, and international solidarity activists. Rasmia was charged with unlawful procurement of naturalization and denied a full and fair trial, which led to her conviction this past November. She now faces time in federal prison and deportation to Jordan. Radio Autonomia was fortunate enough to catch up with Muhammad, a youth organizer from the Arab American Action Network, during the Color of Violence conference in Chicago this past March, where Rasmia was a keynote speaker.
Arab American Action Network, or AAAN, as we kind of colloquially call it, the mission of our organization is really to help the Arab community empower itself, to really be agents in policies and things that happen in their own lives that really directly affect them. And the work that we do, we have this model where we bridge social services and community organizing together as a model for social change. And so we believe that simply helping people find direct services, food stamps, medical assistance, healthcare, ESL classes, citizenship assistance, that's good, and those are necessary, like immediate needs, but they don't solve any of the structural issues that we have, right? And so then we sort of pair that with our community organizing model, which then organizes and centers people who are most affected by these policies that affect the Arab community, low-income, working-class Arab people, at the center of our work as a way for them to be agents of change for these structural policies. So what does that mean in a practical term? Our social services department provides, again, like food stamps, help with Obamacare, medical cards, medical assistance, ESL classes, citizenship classes, and we also have a youth services department that does homework help for K through 8. And then our organizing wing is the youth organizing program, which I personally work in, and that's high schoolers aged 14 to 18, 14 to 19-ish. Then Rasmia's work, which is the Arab Women's Committee, which is a base of 600 to 700 women in the community, mostly immigrants. It's about political education and about community organizing and centering them to try to change and organize around policies.
So you talked a little bit about Rasmia's work. Can you elaborate a little bit more about some of the specifics of her organizing efforts?
Yeah. So the Arab Women's Committee, which is Rasmia's organizing project, just to give a little bit of history, it actually started with Rasmia. So Rasmia's, you know, she's been organizing for a long time, and she does it the old school way. And so she opened up the phone book and looked up all the last names that began with that sounded like they were Arabic, and then called people and said, "Hi, my name's Rasmiya. I'd like to have a cup of coffee with you."
Wow.
And she started meeting women this way. And she said, she started to say, there are all of these women, and we face these really unique challenges as being Arab women, recent immigrant women, many of us refugees in the United States. Why don't we create a space for us, first, to talk about these things, and then, two, to act on some of our challenges. And so her work is, it's hard to really encapsulate, but it can range from, they do writing activities where these women are given skills to help write their life stories. They do education activities, which not only is political education, but also sort of like social and cultural awareness for women in the United States. So an example of that is they brought in a Palestinian woman who works as a drug counselor to talk about signs of drug use and abuse in youth and how to recognize it and really how to deal with it in a productive manner. So that's sort of like, that can be the education aspect. And the third one is really not only the political education, but the political work that gets women to organize for things like immigrant rights, refugee services from the state, like to combat funding cuts for refugee services in the state, to be able to advocate for other families that need assistance, state assistance or things like that. And a way that's really, again, you know, like amplifying the voice of these Arab women as agents in their own lives.
In a nutshell, can you talk about what happened to Rasmiya?
Yeah, so in October 2013, Rasmiya was visited by the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, and they arrested her in the morning and took her downtown in Chicago to federal lockup. And that same day, she was charged with what's called unlawful procurement of naturalization. So what they're alleging is that, you know, she became a naturalized citizen illegally, quote unquote. And all of this stems from a conviction by the State of Israel in 1969, in which she was held in Israel, tortured really unspeakably for 21 days, including sexual torture, physical, psychological, emotional torture, and then signed a confession and was put in front of a military court, found guilty, of course, and in the military courts, 99.7% of all Palestinians are found guilty. So it's a military occupation court where the judge is an Israeli military person. Everybody is an Israeli military person. And she was found guilty. She was put in prison for 10 years and then released in a prisoner exchange. To fast forward a little bit, then she came to the United States in the early 90s. And then in 2004, she became a naturalized citizen. So she went, got her naturalization, became a citizen of the United States. And on the during the naturalization question, they ask, have you been imprisoned? And Rasmiya had been living in the country for 10 years at the time and understood the question to mean, have you been imprisoned in the United States? And so she answered no. And her past is... meaning, you know, what the Israelis had done and what she went through from the State of Israel is a matter of public record internationally. She testified in the United Nations. You know, the U.S. Embassy, her father was a U.S. citizen at the time this happened to her. So the U.S. Embassy was informed of what had happened to her. And so none of it was hidden. And then when she... Sorry, we're kind of jumping a little bit back and forth here. Then when she then went through the naturalization process, then the government said, you intentionally lied on this application to try to hide your past so that you would be able to get naturalization. And that was the charge that they gave her when she was arrested in 2013. And I don't know if you want me to kind of go through the whole, like what happened with the case up until this point now, or if we want to come back to that. Okay, cool. So that's the background then, yeah.
Do you think Rasmiya's case is a byproduct of the anti-war 23 case?
Yeah, so the Midwest 23 case, or the anti-war 23 case, has an interesting connection to Rasmiya's because, a few of the people who were raided or subpoenaed in that case are colleagues or friends of Rasmiya. One of them being Hatem Abudaya, who's the executive director at the Arab American Action Network. Rasmiya is the associate director. And we believe that the United States government, in this, like, you know, fishing expedition, as we call it, that they looked into these 23 people, Hatem being one of them, they then came across Rasmiya and just started digging to try to find anything, right? And reached out to the Israeli government and said, help us send all these documents from Rasmiya's prosecution in the state of Israel. And the FBI worked with the Israeli government to procure those documents and then used it to kind of weave this tale that, you know, she had lied on her immigration application. So there is, you know, there's a correlation, right? There's a correlation between the two things at that level.
Is government repression deterring political activism in Chicago, or is it having the opposite effect as people mobilize around Rasmiya's case?
Yeah, that's a really good question. y'all are good at your job. I think that it's sort of double-edged. There's a reality, and I think we kind of have to speak it, that there's a reality of the fear that kind of comes with seeing a very public, visible figure in the community be attacked and be criminalized and put on trial. And I think that, you know, it's intentional. It's to try to send this chilling, rippling effect throughout the community of, like, hey, you all shut up, you know, stop what you're doing. But in the same right, I think, and a lot of this, I would give credit to Rasmiya personally as a person, to see Rasmiya really withstand, like, the brunt of the United States federal government's attack against her and her people, and to be able to, like, withstand that the way that she does and how she carries herself, I think, has an effect to really empower and mobilize people to say that, you know, if Rasmiya can stand up, we can all stand with her, you know? And then also the fact that she's an icon. She's been an icon for decades. And she's dedicated really her entire life to her people, both while she was in Palestine and Lebanon and Jordan and while she's been in the United States. And so the reality then is that, like, all of these people whose lives she's affected and touched are going to stand with her as well. And so if I could say, I don't think the government hedged their bets correctly this time in terms of, you know, they may have thought that this would be another case that they were able to, you know, be done with quickly. But we pushed back pretty hard.
How can people of color and third world folks draw resilience in moments of intense state repression? And how can we resist scapegoating and or not allow state to divide and conquer?
Oh, that's a good, wow. So I think that to try to make it in a real tangible sense, I think that cases like Rasmiya's make some things really visible for us. There's some, you know, people talk a lot about intersectionality, right? And intersectionality and ideas and whatever, right? But that the arms of repression are very intersectional as well. And so, you know, the repression that each of different communities face, communities of color, oppressed nationalities in this country face, is different. It's markedly different. For example, you know, mass incarceration does not affect Arabs and Palestinians. There's not a large percentage of Arabs and Palestinians, you know, filling prisons in this country. That being said, though, the system of mass incarceration that incarcerates blacks and Latinos in this country is connected directly to the arm of repression that affects Arabs and South Asians and Muslims, which is the national security apparatus. And those things actually feed into each other. And to give a concrete example again, is that, when police are given military equipment in Ferguson, in Chicago, in all over the country now, when police are given military equipment, it's under the guise of fighting terror, under the guise of fighting terrorism. And so the face of terrorism is our community, the Arab community, the Palestinian community, right? But what does it mean materially when the police are given these things? It does not mean that, you know, they're driving tanks in the small pockets of Arab communities across the United States. It means that they're driving tanks inside of black communities, right? And so we see then like the policing and the militarization that's unleashed on the people in Ferguson, for example, is enabled under this guise of fighting terrorism, but affects a substantially different community than what's the face of terrorism, quote unquote. So when we understand sort of how the arms of repression work, I think that it gives us a lens to understand how our work then to counteract that has to be. And so, you know, we do our work and Rasmiya does her work with an intentionality of saying, like, there's this large kind of puzzle, right? And we're one piece of it. But while we're working on changing this one piece of this puzzle, we have to keep this lens of this larger issue, this larger idea of how we still are connected to all these other pieces. And I also say that, you know, there are some amazingly principled organizers from across different communities who have stood with Rasmiya. And, you know, Rasmiya has stood with other people's struggles as well. One of the things she said when the verdict was handed down, when she was first read the guilty verdict and all her supporters were outside and everybody was crying and it was, you know, this big kind of like mess. But she was really kind of like calm and reserved. And she said, I had spoken to her and she said it to me and a few others who were standing around. And she said, in a country in which these courts were used to imprison the Puerto Rican liberation fighters and the Black Liberation Movement and the Chicano Liberation Movement, why do you think they would give a Palestinian any better treatment? And so it was an understanding in terms of, like, how does the system of this criminal justice system, quote-unquote, work and function? And so, again, just to return to the point, like, I think when we have that lens of understanding of how we're each affected, right, materially differently, and it's not the same oppression, and it's not the same way, but it's all part of kind of the same web and the same puzzle, and it's about how we change those pieces that are affecting us.
Going back to specifically Rasmiya's case and kind of the mobilization that has happened around her, what has been kind of one Rasmiya's like actions around? I know she's very limited around legalities of what she can say and things like that. So has Rasmiya been able to have a say in any of the actions on her behalf, and are there any accountability processes in place on how to move forward with the things that the mobilizations that folks have done on her behalf, and is she consulted? Like, just what does that look like?
Yeah, so you know the Rasmiya Defense Committee, what we kind of call it nationally. Obviously is housed sort of in Chicago, right? The people who are closest to her and the people who folks across the country connect with, we're located here in Chicago. And I can say with 100% confidence that nothing from the first day when she was arrested until this moment we're sitting on this table has happened without Rasmiya's knowledge and consent. Locally we meet once every 2 weeks, and Rasmiya is in those meetings with us. And, you know, people have personal relationships with Rasmiya outside of these meetings, and she's consistently consulted, and she's part of the strategic decision-making as well. And so nothing's being done really on behalf of her, you know, nothing about us without us, right? That's sort of the motto we have in the defense work that we're doing. She's consulted on everything, and, you know, nothing's done that would make her uncomfortable, or if she brings up, you know, something that she doesn't want done, it's scrapped, and it's really as simple as that. And then also, you know, that's just that she plays that role where we have to keep in mind that when we're advocating on behalf of somebody, that their voice is ultimately the most important in that process. So
Rasmiya recently spoke at the Insight Color of Violence conference. The theme of the conference was Beyond the State, Inciting Transformative Possibilities. What does it mean to center the lives of immigrant women and trans people in anti-imperialist organizing?
So for her work, what that means is she's organizing amongst Arab immigrant women who are recent immigrants, who are, you know, at best low-income working class, and many of whom are refugees. And for her to center organizing work around these people in a way that it's actually accountable to their needs really provides us with a model and a vision for what does it mean to do like the broader question of anti-imperialist work by centering those voices. So what I mean by that is when you make the theory or the broader political idea of anti-imperialism practical, you have to talk about whose lives does it affect and how. And, you know, I think we'd all be in agreement by saying that, like, immigrant women and then women of oppressed nationalities in their home countries who are low income, right, who become refugees, those are probably the most affected. And so to keep that in mind when we do our political organizing then gives us sort of a handbook of how do we do this then in practical terms. Or when we do our community organizing, gives us a handbook for how do we do it in practical terms when we talk about kind of the broader political issues of anti-imperialism. And so it's what does it mean in very practical terms is that the political work and the community work that you do has to have a direct effect and a direct consequence. I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way, a direct positive consequence in the lives of these people. And so sometimes it means that you view things in a very kind of like practical, local, immediate kind of view, while again having this long vision that we could call anti-imperialist or other things. And I think that that's kind of the model. That's the model that Resmia would use and has kind of taught us. And we replicate in our youth program. But she definitely, you know, focuses it on women in her work.
What have been the ways that the community has resisted in the face of state repression against Resmia and the anti-war 23?
Yeah. So I think the first has been that all of the court mobilizations, so for all of the trial dates, all of the hearings, the sentencing, all of it, really from day one, every time Resmia had a court appearance, we mobilized the community. And, of course, there are, like, activists and people who are a little bit more free to do that kind of political work, right? But the majority of the courtroom, every single day of her trial, was actually packed with the immigrant women that Resmia works with on a daily basis. And these are people who left their families and left their work and left their responsibilities to, you know, drive 5 hours, oftentimes in uncomfortable conditions, or left their families for a week at a time, to be able to support Resmia very visibly. And I think that was one of the most powerful things that I was able to see. Another way, or another piece of that, is that we wrote letters to the judge once when the verdict was first given and she was found guilty. The judge then decided to lock her up, and we had this large letter campaign and call-in campaign, the letters to the judge and the call-in to the jail, in which hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of community members again wrote letters to the judge asking him to release Resmia, which we eventually got. We got her released. And then before the sentencing, we again got hundreds of letters, not only from community members, but also from religious leaders, political leaders. For example, we had a bishop, a former bishop from the Catholic Church in the Michigan area. So really across sectors of society, write to the judge and ask him for leniency in Resmia's sentencing. And he said multiple times throughout the sentencing that he acknowledged that he received a huge outpouring of support from the community, and that, we believe, very much heavily affected the outcome. The prosecution in the case was asking for 5 to 7 years of federal prison time, in addition to deportation. And the judge ended up giving her 18 months of prison, which, of course, you know, we don't believe she should spend a single second in prison. But to give 18 months when the government was asking for 7 years is actually a pretty big victory. And that's, you know, we strongly believe that was because the mass mobilization of people and the mass mobilization for actions that we did in support of Resmia really showed that she had this broad ranging support and she wasn't isolated, and they couldn't just throw her away, you know, or lock her up, throw away the key, and no one would say anything about it.
Just a follow-up question in regards to some of the action, like the ways in which the state actually targeted her. Razmiya spoke a little bit about this experience while at the conference, but she talked about being in isolation and the effects that that has on her, on the body. And so I'm wondering if you can share, maybe speak a little bit about what it means for someone like Razmiya to be placed into isolation in the context of a broader movement against the kind of the shoe, the solitary confinement that that prisoners are leading in the United States. I'm wondering if there was any connections there.
I think that on one level it was that there are maybe people who supported Razmiya who aren't connected to maybe broader issues of prison abolition or even, you know, the lesser prisoner rights type things, right? And I think that seeing and following Razmiya's case and seeing her go through that has woken people up to those issues. And again, it's because that Razmiya herself was very intentional about making those connections and saying that, when she got out, she began to tell people, we need to understand what prison means in this country, right? That that it's a system that destroys people's humanity. And so any of my supporters who think that, you know, prison rehabilitates people or prison is a punishment for people, essentially, I don't want you to think that, right? That's not what it is. It's not that I'm a good person and shouldn't go there and bad people should go there. She's really making a broader critique, which is that, this is an intentional system that destroys the human being at its core. And that was, from my understanding, some of her talk on at the Insight Conference. That aspect of it, again, then, broadens this idea of challenging prisons and challenging the use of isolation to people who weren't necessarily involved in that work. And then on a parallel level, some of us who are more involved in different political realms then are able to have, again, a tangible example, a tangible experience to refer to a person that we know and care about when we're trying to make connections with people as well. And so I think that, it's kind of the piece of the puzzle, right? That it's understanding Razmiya's case in this broader context. And when we're able to do that, we're able to draw connections to people who are doing work against isolation or prison abolition work, other work like that.
If people are interested, how can people plug in? What can folks across the country, like us in California, do to support Razmiya and the anti-war 23 case?
Yeah, so the first is, we're the defense committee's in the 21st century. We have a website and a Facebook and a Twitter and all that great stuff. And the website is justice4razmiya, R-A-S-M-E-A, .org. Same thing for the Twitter handle. And the Facebook page is the same as well, and it's linked through those. It's linked through both the Twitter and the website. Right now, where we're at is Razmiya's attorneys are filing for the appeal, and then the government will have time to respond. And then within the next 6 months, her case will be heard, most likely maybe around September, her appeal case. And so, appeal is a little bit different than a trial. It's not this longer week or 2 week process in which you mass mobilize for. It's a bit of a different game. So right now, what we're asking folks for in a real tangible way is that appeal takes money, and Razmiya has the best attorneys, really, that she could possibly have. She has giants in the world of U.S. political attorneys, and they're working for next to nothing. And so for folks who can donate, they can donate right at the website, and we would definitely ask that. And then the second thing is for people to continue to do this political education campaign around Razmiya's case, draw the connections, the defense committee is more than, you know, we're all over the country, and we're more than happy to send people all over the country. And so we've sent people to California, we've sent people to New York City, we've sent people to Florida. And then we also have our own people in those areas as well that are willing to speak, willing to talk about these issues, and willing to really bring Resmia's case to these different corners and to these different communities. And so those are the two asks that we have now, is directly like for folks who could fundraise and no amount is too small to do that. And then for folks who are able to organize like a political education event around Resmia, they can reach out to us right at the website, justice4resmia.org, and we'll connect them with any resources that they need. And then the last piece that I just want to say, and I know I was thinking about it because I remember Insight a few years ago, they'd kind of written about this need. They ran into this big obstacle, and they had this need to raise a lot of money from the community. And of course, I'm paraphrasing here, right? but they were able to go back to the community and raise a bunch of money. For Asmia's case, we've had multiple fundraisers in which over $10,000, one in which $20,000 was raised. And it wasn't from like doctors and lawyers. While we have plenty of those in our community, and they do give, but it was actually from community members, and in Chicago. And our community in Chicago is largely low income, largely, you know, like service sector or that kind of work. And it was these people who really gave as much as they could, and more than they probably could have, just to support Resmia, and that's what she meant to them. And you know, the women's committee that Resmia works with has raised tens of thousands of dollars for her from the pockets of these women who, again, you know, low-income refugee women. And if they can give, and they can give tens of thousands, anyone can give.
And finally, any other thoughts you want to share in general about your community's journey in mobilizing for Resmia, freedom of speech, and in Palestine?
Yeah, I mean, I think that... it's hard to think of like what's the final thought you want to end on. but I think that I think the lesson here is that we've seen a victory. Resmia's case so far has been a victory of organizing. It's an organizer's victory. The fact that she got 18 months, again, we're not happy, and we're not gonna settle for her to spend a single second in prison. But the fact that she got 18 months when the U.S. attorney and the full backing of the United States government wanted 7 years is an organizing victory. And I think that's been our biggest lesson. And it's been transformative for those of us who are organizers on the campaign for Resmia's defense. And it's been transformative for the community members that have been involved. Resmia's Women's Committee has, you know, this has really been a catalyst for them. And sometimes people learn sometimes from like reading and talking and all of these sorts of things. And people then learn lifetimes of political lessons by experiencing things. And I think that the experience around Resmia's campaign has been, you know, a lifetime's worth of experience in this short amount of time. And that's been the lesson for us. And, you know, for those, it's an old tried and true method. But it drives the point home again that in cases of political repression, it's organizing and it's the people who win these victories. It's not pandering. It's not, you know, it's not asking nicely. It's moving our people and moving our communities to demand, you know, to demand justice for our community members and our community leaders.
Thank you again, Mohammed, for meeting with us. We will have all the resources on our website at radioautonomia.wordpress.com.
Thank you all so much, and it's a pleasure to meet you. Safe travels back.
بيلوموني لاني بالخارج وانت بالداخل عار عالما بيعترف بدور النساء المناضل طول حياتك حمل القضية انسى جنتي وانت حامل فيه اول بكاء اللي كطفل كان فيه صرخة
صرخة حرية اعدام طريق قضبان آسيا انا اسير ابن اسير الطفل الوحيد بسجن نساء انولدت بسجن وانتي لسه عايشة غار كطفل كلبشاتك كانوا العابي كنت ترضيني في الواعي فربيت واعي اكبر فرحة كانت لما طلعلي سلمة شوفت ابوي بس كان لي اكتر منهم ايام تمر ايام تروح وانا ضايق المر اسمي زي الكل اسير او معتقل بعدها بيجي اي رقم البني متوفر اي لون تاني انعدم مصير الاحرار انهطين اسلم هيك سمعت بس ما فهمت لحد ما انحبست صغير لدرجة ان لسه ملحية تسمع اي صديق اي صديق يسألني اتجوزت بفكر بشو عملت بقول الواجب بفكر بشو تركت امي ووطن حالي واذا فكرت بالوالد فيا بشاركني بنفس البرد وبنفس الخبز اليابس وبنفس الشمس مش اللي على دائرة الرسم شمسنا بمربعات صغيرة تنحسر بفكر بالندم نعم على اني انمسكت ولسه شعبي بالظلم ينحكم متخيلك ملاك فستان ابيض وطرحة ردني جنبك تأشاركك بهالفرحة خطفوني لوقت غير محدد قبل ما تلفظ بابا سمعتي حكم مؤبد عندي اليوم والغد كلمات مرادفة اسمي سجن امني عمري 20 روزنامج مفروض معزيمة استقبل فاصلة ابتسم فاصلة اعبدكم وادبك نقطة ريت الحفيد يحضن سيد الرطوبة عجلة الدادة وهم في التاريخة كنت لازم دم تغير تسجن يتحرك هالمستشفى انفضى كلهم كمامات وانا بكلبشات عالسرير ما هو في الجاذبية خايفين اطير لتأجل الفرح بحكي للصورة بحكيكي طريق صورة ريت البطولة اختيار يا ريتها مش مفروضة